So we're going to move on now and talk about hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. And I hear a lot of investigators telling me that this strategy that we're talking about today of adding something to ADT is not done as much as it should be in practice. But I find that surprising because maybe it's the oncologists we're dealing with, because you'll see every time you ask people, they kind of give the right answer. So anyhow, I'm just kind of curious whether that accusation, so to speak, is actually really true. But I refer you to Chris's Talmudic talk, going through so many different aspects of this. Really fascinating. We're just going to pick out a couple of points that Chris has made, but I really recommend you check out the talk. So here's, you know, sort of the introduction to this, Dan. You know, a patient who's had a radical prostatectomy presents 3 years later with three asymptomatic bone mets that are not amenable to ablative therapy. So first of all, it looks like the audience in general is on board, certainly, to do something in addition to ADT. And you can see their preferences, and mainly anti-androgens. Interestingly, also, you know, a little bit of chemotherapy in this sort of lower risk situation. Rob, any comments about this scenario and these answers?
I would point out that I think you attract a subset of really pretty sophisticated folks. Yeah. And I think in the real world,
this is random.
Smart people, because
random people.
Yeah, my colleagues would agree. We see not in significant numbers of patients who are either don't have the conversation. And I think part of it's because you're also querying mostly medical oncologists. And
right. This was medical oncologists. Right. You think it's the urologist?
Well, in fairness, you know, there are folks who manage metastatic prostate cancer to start with hormonal therapy, who are urologists. And, you know, perhaps the uptake of that data is a little less sophisticated in some groups. I mean, I don't want to throw stones, but I think it's a real phenomenon. And I think what you see there is what we see in practice, is that abiraterone is broadly used, and the other agents are data-driven. I don't really think there are too many patients that should not get additive therapy. I mean, so today, essentially all patients should, with really few exceptions.
So we'll talk about that and some of the exceptions that maybe could be considerations. Dan, any comments? Also, another strategy not too many people use, but you see 10-15% of people doing, is starting out with just ADT, see how the patient does, and then if they don't have a great response, adding something in. Any comment on that, Dan? And also how you approach the choice between chemotherapy and endocrine therapy in this situation, Dan?
So I think those patients who... if you're going to take that approach, you have a limited time frame. The trials that have implemented chemotherapy and AD and the next generation agents do that within 3 months of starting treatment. And my feeling is, try to do it early. You know, drugs like apalutamide, enzalutamide, if you're having trouble tolerating, you discontinue it. I'd rather see the benefit given up front. In choosing agents, I try to select them based upon potential side effect patterns and also the extent of disease. I do use chemotherapy for the high-risk, high-volume patients. Also for those patients who may have de novo prostate cancer, as opposed to somebody who was diagnosed with localized disease first, who may be rapidly progressive, younger patients, high Gleason score, Gleason 9, Gleason 10. That, I think, is somebody who's going to get into trouble fairly rapidly. As far as choosing between the different hormonal agents, I used to use a lot of abiraterone. I've been shying away from that based upon some cardiovascular effects I've seen in some people who have been completely asymptomatic. And if we look at the data that was presented last year by the Fox Chase group, there's actually a much, much higher than expected rate of cardiovascular events in patients who are treated with abiraterone and prednisone. Remember that the original trials excluded those patients with significant cardiovascular disease. So we've got to be wary of that fact in our patients and how we select our drugs.
And what's the presumed mechanism of increased cardiovascular risk with abiraterone, Dan?
I think it's threefold. Firstly, you have hypertension, which can develop. Secondly, fluid retention. So if somebody's got a borderline ejection fraction, they may not handle the extra fluid load as well. And there can be a direct cardiac effect of the drug on the myocardium.
So, Chris, in your talk, you go through in detail a bunch of concepts that I think are really interesting, but there are two in particular that really struck me. First, let's just take a look at a couple other scenarios we presented to the same group. So now we're saying the patient has widespread moderately symptomatic disease, a lot more docetaxel. We say their liver mets, a lot more docetaxel. And then, Chris, in your talk, you went through the key trials that sort of were the groundwork for looking at these issues. But what I really wanted to focus on is your interpretation of them. And what really came across as, you know, you were doing this presentation was kind of what Dan just alluded to, not only factoring in volume, but the other factor that you mentioned that kind of hadn't been on my radar enough was, again, de novo versus recurrent or asynchronous, Chris. Rather than going through all the details on the slides, maybe you could just conceptually talk about how you think through these variables and how it translates into what you do in practice, Chris.
So I think it's your clinical intuition on a patient. So if someone presents with a PSA of 50 right out of the gate, you check a scan and he's got multiple bony metastases, this is the de novo high volume, and we know their median survival is 3 years. They do poorly in general. If that same person presents with two bony metastases, the lower burden but still de novo, their outlook is 4.5 years. So some of them do well, some of them do poorly. So the de novo low volume is a bit of a watershed. And then the patient you presented first, late relapse, has low volume, has a median survival of 8 years from the start of the hormones alone. So you can really start to get a feel for what the trajectory is, what the rapidity of its presentation is. And we're much more familiar with cytotoxics for visceral crisis for breast cancer. And so I, recognizing you've got a general medical oncology audience, I liken it to that. It's you need to get more urgent control and get the chemotherapy out of the way. So think of it like how we think visceral crisis breast cancer as opposed to indolent bone-only breast cancer as an analogy.
That is a good analogy. And you had you showed a slide that I'm going to show in a second, but first I want to ask the audience a couple more questions related to your slide. So two scenarios for the audience. You've got a younger patient, no comorbidities, de novo metastatic, high-volume disease. Okay, so generally, how would you approach that patient? And Chris, I'll ask you, in general, how would you approach a patient like that? And then I'm going to ask Rob.
Generally, I sit down with them and say, you're chemo fit, and you have all of these are your options except darolutamide. Darolutamide is not approved and not available in this setting yet. ADT alone, I do not think is the right answer. You can go docetaxel, get into a remission, hold, just continue the hormones, and then add on the new hormones later, or you can add in the potent hormones with it and then add docetaxel later. By getting the docetaxel in, you're getting it in and out of the way when they're fittest. They can have a treatment break with just the castration alone, the testosterone suppression. So I actually have the patient help me make the decision. I don't make it for them. I give them the pros and cons.
Rob, any thoughts on
my approach is very similar to Dr. Sweeney's. Yeah. I think that's exactly spot on.
So here's the other end, older patient, congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease, two asymptomatic biopsy-proven rib mets. So I'm going to ask Dan in a second how we think this through. Would you add anything onto ADT? What would you do with a patient like that? Dan, can you talk a little bit about how you approach situations like that?
So this is not somebody I would give chemotherapy to. He's got two asymptomatic bone mets. I would give him ADT plus apalutamide. I think that's reasonable. I would stay away from abiraterone because of his cardiovascular disease. So either apalutamide or enzalutamide. I prefer apalutamide in this situation. I think it's a little better tolerated. If darolutamide were available, as Chris said before, I think that probably would be the best choice given the fatigue issues. But right now, I would go with apalutamide.
You always see a little darolutamide sneaking in there, but I don't think you can even get it paid for. Chris, what about this situation? Would you consider not adding anything to ADT?
Depends how poorly he is. Recognizing his median survival with ADT alone is 8 years, and his median survival from his age and comorbidities is probably a lot less. I have I've started ADT alone, see how they tolerate that as the first instance, have them come back in 3 months. And I've actually radiated a few of them, their bony metastases, and just said, let's just see how you go with that. And if their PSA gets to less than 0.2, I just continue with the ADT alone. So this is the rare patient where I would go with less, maybe more, and a risk-adapted approach. If they're not getting a good response, then I would add in one of the more advanced hormones.
So there were a couple of sort of slides that you had that sort of summarized some of your thoughts, Chris, about approaching hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Again, I really recommend you check out the talk, but can you just comment on this slide, Chris, and kind of distill a little bit more about how you think through this decision?
So, yes, so I'll walk through this. So I think it's the patient walks in your room. First question, are they fit for chemotherapy? Yes or no? That helps you know, is docetaxel on the table at all? What's the extent of their disease? We've got very consistent evidence of benefit with the hormones in the low volume and the high volume and metachronous and de novo. So that covers the waterfront. Whereas the docetaxel, the signals are mixed. There's absolutely no benefit seen in the subgroups with the metachronous low volume, mixed signals with the de novo low volume, speaking again to them being a hybrid of patients and their disease. So are they fit for chemotherapy? And then start choosing between the hormones versus the other, and also choosing the abiraterone versus the amide based on seizure and blood sugars, as Dan described earlier.
So just to finish this out, Chris, I would like you to talk about your 66-year-old patient initially diagnosed in 2010. Pretty interesting and different case.
It is, yes. So this is a patient who came in and he was a pilot for one of the major airlines doing transatlantic flights, and wonderful personality. And he came in with this discomfort in his pubic bone, high volume Gleason 8 on a biopsy, got a nasty lesion there. We treated him with hormones and radiation. And I said, you know what, I reckon this is relatively isolated. Maybe we can give some really decent radiation to the prostate and the bone met. Stopped the therapy after 2 years and said, let's see how you go. And lo and behold, 10 years later, he is basically still in a complete remission of sorts. But his testosterone is declining with age. And he's still in a great remission. So there are some patients who are extreme responders who can come off of hormonal therapy. And there's this whole new conversation about, is there a role for radiation to oligometastatic lesions? And I'd like to not use the term cure because I'm not sure, but long-term event-free survival with PSA normal and testosterone recovery, and see if they have a better quality of life.
Now, this is a situation that maybe we should have more, exposure to, more people aware of, Dan, in terms of oligometastatic disease. I mean, this is a theme in oncology in general. You hear more and more about, but I don't know that there's enough awareness about this. Any comments, Dan?
Well, I have several patients in our practice just like this, where they have had documented metastatic disease, 2 or 3 metastases. We've treated them with abiraterone, radiation therapy to those particular spots, and then 2 years out, we reimage them. They have no visible disease on scans. I've actually had counseled the patients in that situation, have stopped their androgen blockade, and we've actually had a couple of patients whose testosterone has returned to normal and have not had, at this point, any disease yet. That's non-standard treatment. But the question is, what do you do about these patients, particularly if they're young men, and you're going to be subjecting them to the long-term side effects of ADT? Those, if you're looking at treating these people for 10 years, for example, that's going to have significant effects on their bone health, their cardiovascular health. So I think we really need a good series to really evaluate what the role is of stopping treatment if they have been treated for oligomets and then they have nothing left.
Have you stopped patients, Dan?
Yes. Again, with the caveat that this is non-standard, that they've actually told me they're refusing therapy at that point. But we've made a mutual decision to stop and then to observe them.
So interesting.